Hello and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 42. The Red Wedding. Before we begin, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I'd like to ask you to please subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. It would mean a lot to me and would help more people find the podcast. Thank you for listening. So last time, we discussed the rule of Ebul Qasim while Suleyman's sons were imprisoned in Esfahan. Ebul Qasim ruled in İznik following the death of Suleyman until his assassination, mere months before those of Nizam-ul-Mulk and Melik Shah himself. In the chaos that erupted in Esfahan as al-Dawla al-Nizamiya came crashing down, Suleyman's sons, Kılıç Arslan and Davud, escaped from jail and raced back to İznik. We ended with Kılıç Arslan seizing power in İznik and becoming the second Sultan of Rum, restoring the line of Kutalmish to power. And today, we're going to back up a bit and cover the other beyliks. In particular, what I think is, in many ways, the most interesting of them all. The maritime beylik of the rebel Turkish Roman general Çaka Bey. As we will see, these beyliks were, in some ways, defined by their relationship to Constantinople, and Emperor Alexios Komnenos was determined to bring them into line, to retake the coasts of Anatolia as a base from which to retake the rest of the lost heartland of his empire. And we will also discuss how the return of Kılıç Arslan and the consolidation of power by the new Sultan of Rum upended the situation in western Anatolia, prompting the Emperor of the Romans to call for aid from the west, inaugurating a new type of holy war and summoning a new invader to Anatolia. Now, in order to cover the other beyliks of the west, we need to back up a bit and look at what has been happening in western Anatolia since the fall of Suleyman. In particular, the beyliks ruling on the coastlines of Anatolia. See, sitting in Constantinople, Emperor Alexios had decided that even if the plateau itself was lost to the Roman Empire, perhaps the coastlines of Anatolia could be retaken. So even as he cozied up with Ebul Qasim and the sultans of Rum, he did try to take down the beyliks on the coasts of Anatolia after Suleyman's death. While Kılıç Arslan sat in a jail cell in Esfahan, and Ebul Qasim ruled in İznik, Emperor Alexios Komnenos was busy. And these changes would, of course, impact the Anatolia that Kılıç Arslan found himself in when he finally got back to İznik, because Emperor Alexios is in essence going to unknowingly do Kılıç Arslan a solid by tangling with those beyliks on the coasts of Anatolia. Now, the first of the beys we're going to cover today is actually an emir we briefly mentioned last time, Karategin, who came to rule in Paphlagonia, that is, the Black Sea coast to the east of Bithynia and to the west of Pontus, right in the middle of the north coast of Anatolia, centered around Sinope. Sinope was and is one of the most important Black Sea ports, largely because of its geography. It sits on the very tip of a peninsula jutting out into the Black Sea, connected to that peninsula by only a small and narrow bridge of land. It is therefore extremely easily fortified and possesses an excellent harbor. Likely, it fell to Karategin and his band of Turkmen sometime in the late 1070s or early 1080s. Though just as with the other beyliks, fall isn't really the right word, given that Karategin and his men almost certainly gained control of the city through cutting some sort of protection deal with the local Byzantine elites. Karategin, however, appears to have not been an entirely independent bey. He had some sort of vassalage relationship with the Danishmans, who, if you'll recall from last time, were currently expanding their suzerainty over Ankara and Kayseri. Additionally, based on what some later Crusader sources say, it seems like the Danishmans were in control of Kastamonu, which is the great inland city of Paphlagonia, to the south and west of Sinope. That said, we don't really know the details here. Karategin may have been a vassal of the Danishmans to start with, or he could have been forced to bend the knee after he set up shop in Sinope. Once in Sinope, he did the traditional things Turkish beys did. He began to collect tax revenues that used to be paid to the Byzantine state. Interestingly, Ana Komnena mentions that he destroyed a local church, presumably turning it into a mosque. However, Karategin's rule came to an end after the fall of Suleiman. As we discussed last time, after the fall of the first Roman Sultan, the Seljuk court had sent out emissaries and armies to try to bring the Anatolian beys into line. This had included Borsuk and his army, who were sent to İznik, and who were then driven back by Byzantine and Rum armies, which allowed the Sultanate of Rum to maintain its independence. But the emissary sent to Karategin had more success than Borsuk. See, Melik Shah had sent an Iranian emissary named Siavush to Constantinople. Siavush appears to have then converted to Christianity and defected to the Byzantines. Tellingly, Alexios was far more concerned with retaking the coastlines of Anatolia than displacing Ebul Kasım in İznik or retaking the plateau, something that was clearly impossible for now. Thus, as now a servant of the Emperor of the Romans, Siavush traveled to Sinope. He carried with him both gold from Constantinople and the order of Melik Shah, commanding the beys who made peace with Rome to surrender. Ana Komnena writes, "By showing Karatises, Karategin, the Sultan's epistle, he drove him out of the town without an obol of the emperor's money in his pocket." Siavush then engineered the handover of the city to a certain Constantine Dalisenus, dispatched to the city from Constantinople with a small force for this very purpose. And don't forget that name, Dalisenus. As a reward, Siavush was thereafter made a duke. Karategin himself then disappears from the historical record. Ana Komnena says that he was tormented by a demon, but obviously we can't say that that really happened. However, it is worth noting that he is the subject of a Turkish oral epic legend, later recorded in the Danishmandname. According to the legend, his father was a Turk, forced to convert to Christianity to marry the daughter of a priest with whom he had fallen in love. However, his father continued to live as a crypto-Muslim. Though raised publicly as a Christian, Karategin himself then received dreams of the Prophet Muhammad, which caused him to return to Islam. With the aid of a Danishmand prince and a beautiful Christian Greek girl named Maryam, he frees the Danishmand prince's love interest and other Muslims held captive in the castle of Çankırı by a cruel Christian ruler. Thereafter, Karategin becomes the Bey of Çankırı, and of course, marries the beautiful Greek girl who converts to Islam. What I love about this fictional story, and the real-life story of Siavush, is that they show the fluid border between the Byzantine and Muslim worlds. As much as Byzantine, Seljuk, and then coming Crusader propaganda tries to present Islam and Christianity in black and white terms, with Muslims and Christians as being locked in a brutal struggle, being completely opposed to each other, reality was much messier. There was a great deal of cooperation between Muslims and Christians, and this new frontier zone of Anatolia was a world in religious, cultural, linguistic, and political flux. It was a messy place, full of grays, not the black and white picture that even modern-day religious fundamentalists like to paint. Another bey was the so-called Elchanes, who ruled in Cyzicus on the Sea of Marmara and the region around Ulubat Gölü to the west of Bursa. A variety of theories as to what Elchanes' real Turkish name might have been batted around. İlhan in modern-day Turkish, is widely used in modern Turkish histories. However, this name isn't actually attested to in the Muslim world until the 13th or 14th centuries, because it was basically a Mongol title or name. But that is not definitive proof that it was not in use among the Turks, as Old Turkish and Mongolian do share a lot of common names and titles. Modern scholars think that while İlhan could be the correct name, Elchanes is more likely to be a rendering of Al-Khan. That is, a mix of the Arabic definite article and the title Khan. However, because İlhan is the name generally used in Turkish histories, that's what I'm going to go with for the sake of ease, even though I think there's a high likelihood that this is not correct. İlhan probably started out as a vassal of Süleyman, after Süleyman took Cyzicus during the usurpation of Melisenos all the way back in 1081. Likely, he was the person in charge of the region during Süleyman's reign. After Süleyman's fall, he seems to have broken free from the Sultanate of Rum. Though it's really hard to know exactly how much power İznik ever held over Cyzicus or over İlhan. İlhan is described as being the master of a large number of Turkish troops and as an arch-satrap by Ana Komnena, meaning he was likely a powerful local bey. Sometime in the 1080s, he seems to have set up shop in the city of Gölyazı on Ulubatı Göl, then called Apollonius. Incidentally, this is a charming little town that sits on a very narrow peninsula jutting out into the lake. Because of this geography, it was easily defensible and was a key fortress of the region during both the classical and medieval eras. But at some point in the late 1080s or early 1090s, Alexios Komnenos tried to retake the region from İlhan. Just as with Karategin in Sinop, this was a part of Alexios's attempt to retake the coastlines of Anatolia, even if the plateau itself was lost to the empire. In Constantinople, under the command of a general named Euphorbanus Alexander, the Byzantines loaded ships with siege engines and set out to sail for the Asian coast of the Sea of Marmara. Once there, Alexander and his men navigated their boats up a small river called the Çapraz Çayı to enter the lake of Ulubatı Göl and thus attack Gölyazı itself. This probably involved some portage of the ships at the end, which I'm sure the Byzantine soldiers just loved. They then moved on to besiege the city, which lay on the opposite end of the lake. However, İlhan managed to hold out. Ana Komnena records, Elchanes held on stoutly to the citadel as he expected relieving forces. And indeed, Alexander found out that a large barbarian army was advancing to the assistance of Elchanes, and seeing that his own men were but a small fraction of this new army, it would be wiser, at least, to keep his men unarmed, since his affairs were in a precarious state, and no road of safety remains, he led his men off towards the sea. However, İlhan realized that Alexander and his men would likely make for the exit of the Çapraz Çayı, and he quickly dispatched men to catch them in an ambush as they tried to leave the lake. Komnena writes, "Thus, all our men who were on board these small vessels fell straight into Elchanes' ambush as they passed through the mouth of the lake, and losing their heads at the sight of the sudden danger, they drove the ships to land and jumped ashore. The Turks overtook them, and a serious battle commenced. In the carnage, the Byzantine troops were defeated. Ilkhan seemed to be secure on the southern shore of the Sea of Marmara. However, Ilkhan's rule in Gölyazı came to an end in 1093, just after Kılıç Arslan's return to İznik. Emperor Alexios could not brook the defeat that Ilkhan had inflicted on his expeditionary force. And so, the emperor sent out another army, this time led by a general named Opus. Instead of making straight for Ilkhan's capital at Gölyazı, Opus moved methodically. He marched overland and retook Cyzicus on the shores of the Sea of Marmara, near modern-day Bandırma. He then marched south to retake Poemanenum, a city to the south of Cyzicus and near modern-day Manyas. Ana Komnena says that both cities fell easily. From there, Opus moved east, towards Gölyazı. It seems that in opposing Opus, Ilkhan may have used up his forces, as Ana Komnena says that he now lacked the forces to resist Opus. Realizing that he could not withstand the Romans, Ilkhan decided that if he can't beat them, join them. As Ana Komnena relates, as Alcanes had no longer adequate forces to contend against him, he surrendered the city of his own free will, and he and all of his blood relations deserted to the emperor. Hence, he enjoyed countless privileges and obtained the greatest of all, namely, holy baptism. Thus, just after Kılıç Arslan had retaken İznik, the coast of the Sea of Marmara had been returned to Roman hands. But the most important of all the bays on the coasts of Anatolia was, of course, Chaka Bay. As we discussed in a prior episode, Chaka Bay was unique among the bays. He did not come to power as a traditional Turkish chieftain, but rather as a rebel Roman general. Indeed, in many ways, his polity started off like any of the hundreds of those founded by prior Roman generals who entered into revolt. It's just that Chaka Bey was a Turkish Roman general, and his troops were mostly Turkish and Pecheneg warriors, mercenaries in the service of Byzantium. He was a Turkish raider who had been captured and enslaved before rising through the ranks of the Byzantine military. Indeed, the fact that Chaka Bey was a Turkish Roman general, and most of the troops he brought with him into rebellion were Turkish Roman mercenaries, really shows the extent to which the Turks had implanted themselves in the Roman military system. And it also shows just how much the Beyliks were joint Roman-Turkish projects, built on cooperation. If you're asking yourself, how was it that the Byzantine elites simply acquiesced to Turkish rule? Chaka Bey is a great example and case study. The Byzantine elites were already so used to dealing with barbarian, and indeed Turkish military men, that it was quite easy for them to accept the Turkish Beys, be they rebel generals or newly arrived chieftains leading nomad hordes. Indeed, what's the real difference between the two anyway? Chaka Bey himself was of course a raider at one point in his life, as were the other Beys. Chaka, of course, came to power in İzmir by refusing to accept Emperor Alexios. He had been a loyal servant of Nikephoros Votaniates, to whom he seems to have been originally gifted as a slave. When Votaniates fell, Chaka went into rebellion instead of recognizing the new emperor. He fled Constantinople, sailing down the Aegean coast, and ultimately came to İzmir in 1081. Unsurprisingly, Chaka's Beylik was even more of a fusion state than the other Beyliks. Now, all of the Beyliks were of course built on a fusion of Turkish military power with the continuing Roman state apparatus. But Chaka's Beylik was much more informed by the political legacy of the Roman Empire that it inherited. Indeed, that he himself was a part of, not merely a successor to. Chaka Bey proudly bore the title of Proto Nobilissimus, conferred on him by his late master, Votaniates. This was a Roman title of nobility, and Chaka Bey further emulated Byzantine titles and dynastic concepts. Once in rebellion in Izmir, Chaka Bey used the title Vasileus, Greek for emperor. He also imitated the Byzantine imperial insignia. Indeed, Anna Komnena writes that his goal was, if possible, to climb even the peak of imperial office. Now, this might not be true, but I think it reveals the extent to which Chaka Bey was working within the Roman imperial tradition, really, to an extent the other Beys were not. But this was, of course, a matter of degree, not of kind, because all of the Beys, every single one of them, were inheritors of the Roman tradition and deeply bound up with the institutions of the Roman state, both the court in Constantinople and the institutions that they took over within their own Beyliks. And I think that it is quite interesting and telling that the two Beys who will ultimately come to battle it out for the top spot in Anatolia would turn out to be the most Romanized of all the Beys, the Sultan of Rum and Chaka Bey, the Bey who claimed to be a Vasileus. But we'll get to that in due course. Thus, Chaka Bey set himself up in Izmir. As with the other Beys, his primary military forces were Turkish soldiers. The core of these were, of course, his fellow Turkish and Pecheneg Roman soldiers and mercenaries, men who served the empire before following Chaka into revolt. But they were no doubt augmented by the tribes streaming into western Anatolia. Chaka Bey was totally capable of playing Turkish warlord, and he certainly would have been able to attract the tribes to him. As we discussed in a prior episode, initially, it seems that in the early 1080s, Chaka Bey and Suleiman were allies. They essentially divided up western Anatolia between them. But then Suleiman, of course, rode east to his doom. And as Kılıç Arslan sat in a jail cell in Esfahan, Chaka Bey began to climb to the top of the totem pole in western Anatolia. And interestingly, and quite uniquely, he basically did this through naval victories. Quite a break with tradition for a Turkish Bey. Indeed, Chaka Bey created the first Turkish navy. Now, last time we discussed Ebu'l-Kasım's failed attempt to create a navy in the Marmara in 1085 or 1086, and how Alexios had foiled these plans by having the ships destroyed before they were even really operational. But Chaka Bey actually succeeded in creating the first Anatolian Turkish navy, which is why Chaka Bey's statue can be found in the Naval Museum of Istanbul today, and why the modern-day Turkish Navy's seal prominently features the date 1081. This, in modern-day Turkish nationalist tradition, is the date of the foundation of Turkish sea power, and Chaka Bey remains the spiritual ancestor of the Turkish Navy. Now, the beginnings of Chaka Bey's navy were not illustrious. It was merely a small and motley crew of boats that he used to assist in his capture of the seaside city of Izmir in 1081 after he went into revolt. But as his Aegean Beylik cemented itself after the fall of Suleiman, Chaka Bey began building an actual navy, likely in 1087 and 1088. Anna Komnena records, "At this same time, Chakas, who was assured of the emperor's manifold troubles in the west and of his continuing warfare with the Pechenegs, thought that, as the opportunity offered, he ought to acquire a fleet. And chancing upon a certain Smyrniote, that is a Greek resident of Izmir, he entrusted the building of pirate vessels to him, for he was experienced in this work. This new fleet was reportedly quite large, consisting of biremes, triremes, and dromons, and 40 covered trawlers. Biremes and triremes were, of course, the classic boats of Mediterranean warfare going back millennia. They were long boats with both oars and a sail. Usually, they were about 25 meters long and a mere 3 meters or so wide at the beam. They lacked covered decks and basically looked like gigantic canoes with pointed rams on the bow, a single mast, and a bank of oars. They would be powered under sail when not in combat, but in battle, rowers would man the long banks of oars and furiously row the ships into combat, where they would ram each other with their pointed rams on their bows. The crews would then attempt to board each other's boats and fight hand to hand. The boats would also, of course, be manned by archers, who would fire volleys of arrows back and forth. As the name suggests, biremes had 2 banks of oars and triremes 3. Dromons, on the other hand, were a more modern type of ship. An evolution of the trireme, the dromon was also a type of galley ship made by the Byzantines. However, the dromon was a bit larger and had a full deck, not just an open canoe-style hull. Dromons also had triangular lateen sails and lacked the rams of the older biremes and triremes. Instead, they had above-water spurs with which to hit their prey. Incidentally, the building of the Yenikapı train station in Istanbul uncovered the remains of dozens of dromons, which dramatically slowed its opening. And of course, Çaka Bey loaded onto his new fleet his mighty Turkish horse archers, marrying sea power to steppe power. His fleet would transport his nomad warriors to the Greek islands, where they could then attack the Roman garrisons. I wonder how the nomad warriors themselves felt about all of this, of course. Many, I am sure, would have never seen the sea before arriving in Çaka's beylik, and many more would have never set sail. But this marriage of ships built and manned by Greeks transporting Turkish nomad warriors is both fascinating and I think emblematic of Çaka's beylik. In a sense, it is even a broader analogy or symbol of all of the beyliks, the melding of the Turkish and the Roman. With this fleet, Çaka Bey then set out to conquer the Aegean. His first move was to strike Urla, down the Çeşme Peninsula from Izmir, a peninsula that juts out to the west of Anatolia like a fist making a thumbs up. Urla is today a very nice vacation area with some really quite nice vineyards and restaurants. But at this time, it was an important trading city named Klazmone with ancient roots. After taking Urla and confirming his domination of the entirety of the Çeşme Peninsula, Çaka took his fleet and crossed back to the east, capturing the city of Foça, across the Gulf of Izmir from the Çeşme Peninsula. With Foça's submission, the entirety of the Gulf of Izmir was under Çaka Bey's suzerainty. This was a key region of the Aegean coast. But Çaka Bey did not stop there. From Foça, he dispatched messages to the Roman commander on the island of Mytilene, that is the island of Lesbos. Lesbos is to the northwest of Foça and across the water from Ayvalık. Ana Komnena relates, he sent letters to the curator Olopus, the administrator of Mytilene, threatening him with dire punishment unless he left the town very quickly. He told him also that he wished him well and had for that reason warned him of the terrible future that awaited him if he did not depart. Olopos was thoroughly scared of Çaka's threats, so embarked on a vessel by night and made for the capital. And with the Roman curator thus scared off, Chakabe sailed into Lesbos and took it basically without a fight. The only part of the island that refused to submit was the small fortress of Methymna on the northern coast of the island, which Chakabe didn't really consider to be a big deal. Below consideration, in the words of Anna Komnena. He then sailed off to force the island of Chios to submit, that is, Sakızadası in Turkish. Chios is the Greek island visible from the Çeşme Peninsula and near to Chakabe's home base in Izmir. Meanwhile, Emperor Alexios Komnenos was no doubt furious when he saw Curator Alopus arrive back in Constantinople with the news that he had basically given up Lesbos without a fight. Alexios decided that he had to retake Lesbos, and so he pulled together a naval expeditionary force to retake the island, starting by reinforcing the Byzantine garrison holding out in Methymna in the north of the island. However, this attempt to reinforce Methymna and retake the island was easily pushed back by Chakabe. When he heard of the landing of the Roman reinforcements in the north of the island, he gathered up his fleet and left Chios. He sailed north, back to Lesbos, and began organizing a defense of his new island turf. The Roman expeditionary force was then easily defeated by Chakabe's army and fleet, and Chakabe even managed to seize the ships used to transport the Byzantine army. However, Methymna itself remained loyal to Constantinople. The very northern tip of the island was thus outside of Chakabe's sovereignty. His fleet thus further augmented. Chaka sailed back to Izmir in 1088, probably quite happy with himself. But in Constantinople, Emperor Alexios Komnenos was furious. He assembled yet another naval expeditionary force, this time determined to retake Chios. The army was composed of both Roman soldiers and Latin mercenary knights, and was placed under the command of that general I told you not to forget, Dalesenos. This army sailed off to Chios immediately. But knowing that it might require more to defeat Chakabe, Emperor Alexios also summoned from the Balkans Duke John of Dyrrhachium, a capable general who had spent the last decade retaking much of the Balkan coastlines lost to the empire in the crisis since Manzikert. As Duke John prepared for his new assignment, Dalesenos and his men reached Chios. Chakabe had been informed of their approach, and himself had set off for the island with an army of 8,000 Turkish warriors. His fleet picked up his army somewhere on the Çeşme Peninsula and set off for Chios. Dalesenos had meanwhile embarked his soldiers and ordered the fleet that had transported them to Chios to find and engage Chaka's fleet, which he was sure must be approaching from somewhere. However, when the Roman fleet finally sighted the approaching Turkish fleet, they were astounded. Chakabe had gotten a long chain and essentially tied his vast fleet together. There was no way for any of the vessels to turn and escape. They were all in this together, in a literal sink or swim situation. Anna Komnena reports that when the Roman admiral saw this new arrangement of Chaka's fleet, he was horror-struck and did not dare approach it, but turned his helm and made for Chios. But Chaka pursued him and did not slacken in his rowing. Chased by the Turkish fleet, the Romans made for a town in the north of the island that Dalesenos had captured. Chaka, however, passed by this port and made for a nearby citadel. His men disembarked, and Chaka began preparing his Greek infantry and Turkish horse archers for battle. Dalesenos, meanwhile, abandoned the camp that he had previously prepared and ordered his men to dig trenches, a traditional tactic when facing superior cavalry, as horses will generally refuse to charge into a pit. The next day, Chaka's army, of course, appeared before the new Roman position. The Byzantines stayed put behind their trenches, refusing to move, as the Turks began riding up and peppering them with volleys of arrows, as was the traditional steppe tactic. A steppe tactic now transported to a Greek island. But instead of chasing after the Turks, annoyingly, the Romans refused to budge. This must have been incredibly difficult for the Latin mercenary knights who made up a large part of the Byzantine force and who, of course, always valued the charge. Finally, however, Chaka Bey was able to provoke the Latin knights into a fight. Anna Komnena relates what happened. Then Chakas egged on the larger part of his barbarian army to attack the Romans and bade a very few horsemen to follow them up. At this, the Latins took out their long spears and rode out against them, but the barbarians did not aim their javelins at the Franks, but at the horses, and some they struck with their spears. Thus they killed a great many, routed others, and drove them into their camp lines, but they in a mad rush made out from them towards their ships. This rout by the Latin knights then precipitated a general rout of the Roman army. One group of Roman soldiers managed to get to the walls of the town they had first captured, but that left the road down to the port open to the Turks. The Turks rushed forward and started seizing the Roman ships. In response, the sailors loosed the cables, pushed off quickly from the shore, cast anchor, and waited to see what would happen. As the Turks were busy seizing those ships that didn't cast off, Dalesenos managed to flee back with a few remaining troops and board the ships that had escaped the Turks. With this shattered force, he sailed around Chios to the western side of the island, ultimately hunkering down in the city of Bolissos. Chaka Bey learned of this and sent off messengers to negotiate with Dalesenos. According to Anna Komnena, the two leaders met outside of Bolissos. There, Chaka Bey laid out the history of his dealings with the Roman Empire and the circumstances that led to his rebellion against Emperor Alexios. He reportedly said, "Let the emperor be told of them, and if he wishes the enmity that has arisen to be brought to an end, then let him restore to me in full all the privileges due to me, of which I have been deprived." He then further proposed to Dalesenos a marriage alliance between their children. Anna Komnena says, "Dalesenos looked upon all of this as empty talk, as he knew well the crafty nature of the Turks, and therefore put off indefinitely the fulfillment of his demands." Reportedly, Chaka's last words to Dalesenos was the cryptic phrase, "It is already night. It is well to obey the voice of night." Dalesenos hoped to delay until the arrival of Duke John of Dyrrhachium. Chaka, however, upon hearing of the planned arrival of the Duke, decided to return to Izmir to get further reinforcements. So after promising to send supplies to Dalesenos and his men, he instead left in the middle of the night, sailing on a favorable wind back to Izmir. While Chaka was in Izmir, Dalesenos left a small force to garrison the city of Bolissos, and with the rest of his fleet, returned to the toehold of the empire on Lesbos. Duke John's arrival stabilized the situation. The Roman Empire retained its toeholds on the main islands of the region, but Chaka's Beylik was not able to be beaten back. Chaka Bey controlled most of both Lesbos and Chios, and likely all of the smaller islands in the region, as well as the Anatolian coast itself. We know from an offhand reference in Komnena's history, for example, that the fairly large island of Samos off the coast of Ephesus was in Chaka's hands. Furthermore, he was likely the suzerain of a handful of smaller bays in Kushadasi, Ephesus, and the regions to the south of Izmir. These bays' names were likely Tandra Vermish and Barak or Marak, rendered as Tangri Permes and Marakes by Anna Komnena. And with Constantinople facing a vicious war against the Pechenegs in the Balkans, there was simply nothing further that Emperor Alexios could do about this new, powerful Aegean Beylik. So by 1089, Chaka Bey was basically the most powerful Turkish potentate in western Anatolia. Indeed, it is from this time that Ana Komnena writes of him, he had adopted the insignia of an emperor, styled himself emperor, inhabited Izmir as if it was his place, and was now equipping a fleet with which to devastate the islands again and push on to Byzantium, and, if anyhow possible, to have himself exalted to the imperial eminence. With Kılıç Arslan in prison in Esfahan, and Ebul Kasım having been forced into a more subservient relationship with Constantinople, Chaka Bey was the foremost Turkish leader. And he was also one of the key maritime lords of the Eastern Mediterranean. Indeed, some modern historians believe that he may have been working in concert with other rebel Roman generals operating on the seas of the Eastern Mediterranean, namely Raposomates in Cyprus and Kariakes in Crete. Quite an achievement for a Turkish warlord. Apparently shaken by the emergence of this maritime Turkish bey, Alexios again tried to clip Chaka Bey's wings. As he was still engaged in a bitter war with the Pechenegs in the Balkans, Alexios was again limited in the forces he could muster. So in spring 1092, just as Ebul Kasım was riding east from İznik towards his assassination, Alexios sent John Dukas out against Chaka Bey with a relatively small force. Dalesenos was appointed to head the fleet and given the title Thalassocrator, which is a Greek title that I just love because it basically means the Lord of the Ocean. John Dukas marched overland from Constantinople, likely boarding a ship somewhere near modern-day Ayvalık, and transporting his men over the narrow gulf to the island of Lesbos. Once there, he set up shop near Mytilene, the largest city on Lesbos, and began launching attacks on Chaka's garrison inside. According to Ana Komnena, this garrison was commanded by Chaka's brother, whose name she renders as Galabatses. This is likely a rendering of Yalvach. Yalvach was apparently a well-respected commander, who held his own against Dukas in the initial engagements. Chaka Bey soon arrived from İzmir to take command of the garrison. Thereafter, Dukas besieged Chaka, Yalvach, and the Turkish garrison in Mytilene for 3 months. This can be absolutely brutal in the heat of the Mediterranean summer, of course. And as Ana Komnena writes, and yet Dukas gained no advantage from his continued toil. According to Ana, it was her father, still in Constantinople, who upon hearing reports of the lengthy siege wrote to Dukas to advise that the Duke wait until afternoon to fight so that the sun would be in the eyes of Chaka's troops, but that's exactly the sort of detail that you can't trust. Regardless of the details, Chaka Bey and his men were eventually worn down and forced to negotiate a surrender. The two sides reportedly agreed to an exchange of hostages for mutual security, and that Chaka Bey would turn over the fortress and be entitled to return to İzmir. Chaka was to hand over two of his commanders, Komnena calls them satraps, and take as hostages the local Greeks, who he was to release before boarding his ships. However, according to Komnena, the crab never learns to walk straight. No more did Chaka depart from his former villainy, for he attempted to carry away all the Mytileneans together with their wives and their children. Chaka thus boarded his ships and set sail for İzmir. Meanwhile, the Thalassocrator Dalesenos sailed quickly for Chaka's fleet. He reached it just as Chaka weighed anchor, and a vicious naval battle ensued. Reportedly, Dalesenos was able to capture a number of the vessels and put everyone in them to death. However, Chaka Bey was able to escape with a portion of his fleet and safely got to İzmir. Thus, Chaka Bey lost Lesbos, or at least a large part of it. The Thalassocrator Dalesenos then managed to restore Byzantine sovereignty over Samos and several of the smaller islands, though not over Chios. And indeed, it seems that this restoration of imperial control over these Aegean islands must have been short-lived. Despite Anna Komnena's attempts to dress it up, it appears from later events that by 1091 or 1092 at the latest, these islands were back in Chaka's hands. And these years, 1091 and 1092, were of course truly momentous. In 1091, Alexios Komnenos finally ended his great war with the Pechenegs. Allying with other Turks, the Turkic Kupchaks or Cumans, Alexios was able to inflict a crushing defeat on the Pechenegs on April 29, 1091. The battle took place at Enez, right on the borders of modern-day Greece and Turkey, where the river Meriç flows into the Aegean. This relieved immense pressure on Byzantium in the Balkans, freeing Alexios up to consider what to do about the Turks in Anatolia, and from where he could possibly raise troops to oppose them. You know, foreshadowing. But from our perspective, the most important event is of course the return of Kılıç Arslan from his jail cell in Esfahan. As discussed last time, in late 1092, Kılıç Arslan returned to İznik and claimed his birthright. He began cementing his power in İznik immediately upon his return. He deposed Ebulgazi Hasan Bey and installed one of his loyalists, Muhammad, as his second in command. And he granted to the Turkish potentates the right to bring their wives and families into İznik and the other cities of the Sultanate. To set themselves up in at least some of the palaces and estates of the old Roman elite. Doubtless, of course, those local Christian elites who cooperated and were critical to the regime were of course taken care of as well. Now, as we will discuss in later episodes, the Muslim histories are full of anachronisms that try to project backwards in time Kılıç Arslan's dominant political position. In particular, the seismic changes to the Turkish political world of Anatolia created by the coming invasion of the Crusaders. But that said, we can safely say that Kılıç Arslan did try to expand his power and enforce his self-proclaimed rights as a sultan basically immediately upon seizing power, to try to become the overlord of the Turks of Western Anatolia. And the first thing he did appears to have been to reach out to Chaka Bey, the lord of the waves of the Aegean and the greatest Turkish potentate in Western Anatolia, aside from himself. We don't have details about their first contact, but it must have been basically immediately after Kılıç Arslan's return. And the two sides both had something to offer the other. Chaka Bey, of course, had his navy, but he was also the suzerain of the coast of Anatolia, and thus capable of calling on a deep well of troops and fleets. For his part, Kılıç Arslan, of course, had his own troops and the territories of the interior of Western Anatolia. But he had something even more valuable, his name and his lineage, the prestige of the House of Seljuk itself. And so, sometime in early 1093, Kılıç Arslan and Chaka Bey entered into an alliance, one sealed with marriage. Kılıç Arslan wedded Chaka Bey's daughter, making the Turkish Roman general the father-in-law of the Sword Lion. This marriage into the House of Seljuk was of great value to Chaka Bey. It was a mark of legitimacy, of prestige. And this alliance of Kılıç Arslan and Chaka Bey, İznik and İzmir, created the most powerful political bloc in Western Anatolia, at least for a short time. Because this İznik-İzmir axis would not be long-lived. Emboldened by his alliance with the newly arrived Sultan of Rum, his new son-in-law, Chaka Bey decided to make a power play. In summer 1093, mere months after Kılıç Arslan's marriage to his daughter, Chaka Bey sailed north to the Dardanelles, the straits dividing Europe and Asia and connecting the Aegean to the Sea of Marmara itself. Basically, Constantinople's maritime front yard. There, he put the city of Abydos on the European shore to siege. Chaka Bey's old enemy, the Thalassocrator Dalassenos raced to relieve the city. This attack by Chaka Bey was of course incredibly provocative to Emperor Alexios, who rightly looked on this alliance between Chaka Bey and Kılıç Arslan with great fear and trepidation. If Chaka Bey was able to secure the Dardanelles Straits, the entirety of the Sea of Marmara, even the capital of Constantinople itself, would not be safe. And if his ally and son-in-law Kılıç Arslan joined him, well, then the consequences could be so terrible that they could not be contemplated. Alexios' whole long-term project of securing the coastlines of Anatolia while he husbanded his forces to retake the peninsula would be dashed. So naturally, being the crafty emperor that he was, Alexios decided that he had to break this alliance up. He sent emissaries off to Iznik bearing a letter which I'm going to read in full. "Most glorious Sultan Kılıç Arslan, you know the rank of Sultan is yours by heredity. Now your kinsman by marriage, Chakas, is preparing war to all seeming against the Roman Empire, and he calls himself emperor. But this is only a transparent pretense, for he is too worldly wise and well informed not to see that the Roman Empire is not for him, and that it would be impossible for him to ever grasp its scepter. His whole mischievous device is really planned against you. It is your duty, therefore, not to bear against him, and not be dilatory, but rather to wake up if you do not wish to be deprived of your kingdom. I, for my part, will, with God's help, drive him out of the countries under the Roman jurisdiction, and in my affection for you, I adjure you, on your side, to take thought for your kingdom and power, and bring that man into subjection, either by peaceful methods, or, if he rejects those, then by the sword." And it turns out that Emperor Alexios was preaching to the choir, because Chaka Bey's move to take the Dardanelles was also incredibly provocative for Kılıç Arslan. He was happy to ally with Chaka Bey if that meant carving up Western Anatolia between them and aiding each other for mutual defense against other powers, like the Danishmends, Tutushan Syria, or even the Byzantine Empire. But if Chaka Bey actually secured the Dardanelles, that wouldn't just put him on the doorstep of Constantinople and the Byzantine possessions in the Marmara, it would put him on the doorstep of Iznik and the heartland of the Sultanate of Rum. No doubt, Kılıç Arslan feared the potential consequences of this for his young regime. Remember, he had only been the Sultan in Iznik for a couple of months at this point, and Chaka Bey was now his father-in-law. His prestige had been greatly enhanced by the marriage. Who knew? Maybe Chaka Bey could replace him and his fledgling court. Additionally, Chaka Bey's actions were threatening to draw Kılıç Arslan into a serious conflict with Constantinople, also something Kılıç Arslan was very wary of given the youth of his regime. And on the other side, no doubt, if he rode to the aid of Alexios, then he himself would gain the recognition of Constantinople, which would of course be extremely valuable, as he had just come to power. It would allow him to present himself to the existing Byzantine elites he relied upon, and the other Turkish beys, as a sultan recognized by the Roman emperor, an equal of Constantinople, and a legitimate ruler. Thus, mere months after making their alliance, Kılıç Arslan decided to turn on his new father-in-law and come to the aid of the Emperor of the Romans. As Chaka Bey besieged Abydos, Kılıç Arslan marched his armies out of Bithynia and rode west towards Çanakkale and the Asian shores of the Dardanelles. Upon hearing of the approach of Kılıç Arslan and his army, Chaka Bey became disquieted. He had not called for aid from Kılıç Arslan, so why was the Sultan arriving? Chaka must have feared that he had miscalculated, and there was no way that he could withstand the combined might of the Roman fleet under the Thalassocrator Dalassenos, the Roman garrison in Abydos itself, and the Turkmen warriors of the Sultan of Rum if it came to that. but it was also not yet clear to Chaka Bey whose side Kılıç Arslan was on. As he saw the Sultan of Rum make camp across the waters on the Asian side, it was at least conceivable that Kılıç Arslan had come to his aid, or at least that he could be convinced to aid him. And then an invitation came to Chaka Bey from his son-in-law, Kılıç Arslan, now camped with his army on the other side of the narrow straits, to visit and to dine with him. And so it was that Chaka Bey faithfully accepted the invitation of Kılıç Arslan. He crossed the Dardanelles and came to the camp of his son-in-law, the Sword Lion. This was likely the first time the two men had ever laid eyes on each other. Kılıç Arslan graciously invited Chaka Bey to dine with him, to celebrate the union of their houses and their grand alliance. In a sense, a belated wedding party. Anna Komnena relates what next occurred. The Sultan, on beholding him, showed him great countenance and received him graciously, and had a table set before him according to custom, supped with him, and obliged Chakas to drink somewhat too hard. When he saw that the latter was full of wine, he drew his sword and drove it into his side. Thus Chaka Bey fell dead on the shores of the Dardanelles, murdered by his son-in-law, Kılıç Arslan, the Sultan of Rum. What can we say about Chaka Bey? His legacy in Turkey today is mostly naval. He is pointed to as the father of the Turkish Navy. His statue is in the Naval History Museum, and the date of the foundation of his fleet, 1081, even appears on the coat of arms of the modern Turkish Navy. And indeed, Chaka Bey was the first Turkish leader to really have a navy, the first to leave the saddle for the ship. There is something to celebrate and remember in his great naval victories. But to me, Chaka is more interesting for the way he combined the Roman and Turkish traditions and truly embodied the messy and muddy nature of the Roman-Turkish frontier world that arose in Anatolia. He was born as a steppe nomad and had started out by raiding the Byzantine Empire before being captured and enslaved and fighting for Rome. He became a Roman general, even receiving titles of Roman nobility, before rebelling and becoming a Turkish bey. But even then, the act of rebellion by a general was in some ways a deeply Roman thing, part of the long political tradition of the empire. And as a Turkish bey, he continued to use Roman titles and symbols of power. Even more than the other beyliks, his was a state based on cooperation between Turks and Romans. Indeed, his fleet, built and crewed by Greeks and transporting Turkish nomad warriors, was maybe the most tangible example of this. Following the death of Chaka Bey, Kılıç Arslan's position as the foremost Turkish leader in western Anatolia was confirmed. Emperor Alexios seems to have retaken many of the Greek islands, though Chaka Bey's son, likely also named Chaka, was able to hold onto Izmir and its environs, as well as parts of Chios in all likelihood. As he had with İlhan and Karategin, the emperor had managed to claw back some measure of imperial authority on the coasts, even if total sovereignty still eluded him. But in the interior of Anatolia, on the plateau itself, Turkish rule was cemented. The primary beneficiary of this was Kılıç Arslan and his sultanate. As Alexios consolidated Roman power over the coasts of Anatolia and began pondering how he could possibly retake the rest, Kılıç Arslan began moving east to entrench the power of the Sultanate of Rum in Anatolia and indeed beyond. Based on later events, at some point in 1093 through 1095, he likely vied with the Danishmans for control over Ankara and Kayseri, seeking to consolidate the power of the Sultanate of Rum in central Anatolia. And then, in 1095, as we covered in our episode on the Seljuk collapse, Tutush fell in Iran during his desperate struggle with Berkeruk for the control of the empire. the rule of the sons of Tutush in his old Syrian heartland thus came into question. Apparently, in an attempt to take advantage of this opportunity and to outmaneuver the Danishmans, Kılıç Arslan led an army east in 1095. His goal was to take the city of Malatya. Malatya sits on the banks of the river Euphrates, in the mountains that rise up from the plains and deserts of Syria into the Anatolian plateau. Once upon a time, it had served as the bulwark of the Roman Empire against the Arab raiders during the glory days of the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphates. It sat on key trade routes both from east to west and from north to south. It was therefore of great economic importance, in addition to strategic importance, and it is probable that, like his father, Kılıç Arslan entertained notions of returning to the east, to use his strong position in Anatolia as a base from which to play Seljuk politics and increase his power in the richer and more central lands of the Muslim world. Sultan Kılıç Arslan put the city to siege in 1096. With the fall of the city, his control over western and central Anatolia would be secured, and maybe even, in the chaos of the Seljuk civil wars, the line of Kutalmış would conquer further. But it was not to be. Kılıç Arslan's siege of Malatya would last less than a year, and the Sword Lion would soon be racing back west as fast as humanly possible. He would be forced to face a new and truly existential threat from the West. Because next time, we will discuss how, facing the stark reality of permanent Turkish rule in Anatolia, Emperor Alexios Komnenos had, in desperation, called for aid from the West.